It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker for today, Andrew Quackenbush. And he will be introducing us to ideas around interspiritual competence. Andrew attended his first Unitarian meeting in 1994 and has participated regularly since then at congregations in Kingston, Ontario, North Vancouver, BC, and now at the Regina Fellowship. Since 2002. He is an avid genealogist, a published writer of fiction, a French horn player in two local brass groups. I seem to have something missing from your bio, because it says, and then there's nothing else. I have the article. What comes after that? You can add the rest. What was it? And a teacher, and he's also a program head at Saskatchewan Polytechnic, in the basic education program.
Thanks, Ingrid. When I was doing my education degree, I was friends with a woman in my classes named Natalie, who is from Timmins, Ontario, and is Francophone. Through the French community at Queen's, where we were attending school, she was friends with a man named Michel. Michel and his roommate invited Natalie to a party, and Natalie asked me if I'd like to go. I agreed to meet her at Michel's place the following Friday. I arrived on time, but Natalie was a bit late. The noise of the party was spilling through an open doorway, so I just walked in. The house was full of strangers, all busy with conversation. A group of guests was clustered around Michel, all laughing and carrying on in French. Not the simple, slow-paced academic French I might have been able to understand, but the idiomatic and rapid-fire language of young people who are engaged with humor and relaxing after a tough week of university classes. A second group was clustered around Michel's roommate, who was hearing impaired. All of his friends were also laughing, but communicating through the excited gestures of sign language. I don't know sign language, other than the alphabet, which was of no practical use at that point. I sat down alone on a love seat by the front window, feeling completely isolated in a crowded room. Fortunately, I spotted a dog across the room who would be good company. I patted my knee and the large dog bounded over and jumped on me with a vigor that left me defending myself with my arms over my face and shouting, "Down, down, sit." The dog didn't listen and continued to attack my face with its slobbery tongue. Michel saw the episode and came to my rescue and with a single command, "Sit," spoken in French, the dog immediately dropped down on the floor. The point of this story is that communication is important. But we all have ways of communicating that are accessible or inaccessible to various degrees, depending on how congruent our culture is with the culture of our audience. I had an opportunity recently through work to take some training around the idea of intercultural competence. Intercultural competence it's a buzzword now that refers to how adept a person is in their relationships with people who are, for cultural reasons, different. In this training, we learned about a tool called a development index, which is a survey that measures a person's intercultural competence and locates them on a continuum. This continuum is a scale that indicates the level of intercultural competence from not competent at all to very competent. I'm fairly skeptical by nature about these sorts of things, but by the end of the workshop, I was for the most part convinced that this tool does indeed do a reasonable job of assessing how interculturally competent a person is. There are different models and measurements in different systems of testing, but in the one that I learned about, there are five stages in the continuum. There is an implied assumption in the system that stage one, which is denial, is the least desirable, and that stage five, called adaptation, is the most desirable. Someone scoring low on the index of intercultural competence might say, sure, those people are different, but it has nothing to do with their culture. It's who they are that's the problem. Someone a little more developed on the scale might say, sure, those people are different, and it's their culture that is the problem. They should go back to their own country. In the middle of the spectrum, someone might say, sure, those people seem different, but really they're just like us. Human beings all want the same things in life, so let's ignore cultural differences and focus on what we've got in common. Why can't we all just get along? The next stage is marked by statements like, she and I could relate more effectively, but our cultural differences are a barrier. I want to work with her, but I really don't know what to do. People in the highest stage of competence, called adaptation, alter their own behaviors and words to take up the position of those who are different, crossing over and assuming the culture of another person. This would involve adopting not only the superficial differences of culture, such as food rituals or clothing, but also the deeper aspects of cultural difference, such as changing one's own conflict resolution style or adjusting how direct one is in their communication style. This allows one to take on the culture of another of other people, making those people feel comfortable and open to further growth and connection in relationship. I am supposing that people like Grey Owl, the British-born man who lived amongst the Canadian Aboriginal peoples and took on their identity, and John Howard Griffin, the white Texan journalist who lived amongst the blacks of the South and wrote the book Black Like Me, would be examples of expert adapters. The intercultural adapters are positioned to act as bridges between different cultural groups and can be witnessed, as can be witnessed, through the influence of the writings of these two examples. So the title of my talk is Interspiritual Competence. If you were keen, you might have gone to the internet to try to answer the question, what is interspiritual competence, in advance of this morning's presentation. Google usually gives us an incomprehensible number of hits for a given search phrase, but when I Googled this, it gave just two. And that's because I made it up. But apparently I wasn't the first person, because one of those hits is actually for our service this morning. But the other hit was a website from 2004, so I wasn't being completely original anyway, since this is simply a variation of the more well-established term intercultural competence. I see that other people have coined the terms interfaith competence and interspiritual development. This training through work started me thinking about what interspiritual competency might be, if it exists. What would it look like? A person adopting any fundamentalist religious position would be in a lower stage, where the I'm right, you're wrong attitude promotes a polarization of beliefs. Someone who is advanced on the spectrum might attend a variety of religious organizations and adopt a variety of religious practices. The purposes for doing this might include learning what other people believe and how they live out their spirituality, simply to satisfy curiosity, or to discover things that help with finding one's own spiritual path, or to improve dialogue, or to learn systems that work for the intent of finding ways to sustain one's own organization, or another purpose, less probably for us here, to gain trust to effect religious conversion on someone else. Interfaith is a term, to me, that speaks of community, the public recognition of acceptance of another group's faith. Interspiritual, to me, speaks more of personal connections between individuals rather than the group. Intercultural competence refers to the ability to adapt superficial cultural markers, such as food and dress, as well as deeper differences. Interspiritual competence could as well span a spectrum of difference. The more superficial ones might involve prayer or dress, while deeper ones might be the source of ethics and morals. I was at a teepee raising ceremony recently, which included prayer and smudging. I personally have not yet learned to attach meaning to either of these practices. So, should I participate? I could choose to not participate to make a statement that prayer and smudging have no meaning for me. But in a community of people who attach value to these things, what would not participating really accomplish? When I'm at an event where the Lord's Prayer is recited, perhaps a funeral, I could choose to not say the words, to make a statement that I'm different from others in my beliefs. But again, what does non-participation really accomplish? Well, a few things. If I'm trying to proselytize and I think that someone will notice me not praying, it's a way to open the door for communication. But I don't, and Unitarians generally, I think, don't believe in the need to get converts to Unitarianism. Though I do believe that getting people to adopt the values of Unitarianism would positively affect the world. Another reason I might not say the Lord's Prayer or engage in smudging is that someone who doesn't know me might think I believe in it when I don't. At one time, this would have been important to me, but as I get older, I care less about what others are thinking of me, so this isn't really such a big factor. Finally, I might not say the Lord's Prayer because it feels inauthentic. I'd be going through the motions without the meaning, which feels hypocritical. I'm guessing that this would be the most likely reason for people here to not engage in religious practices of others. As with adapting to intercultural difference, interspiritual adaptation would probably involve a degree of disingenuousness. You might feel like a fraud or struggle with the inauthenticity of repeating a confessional liturgy, for example. When in elementary school, I felt bad for that Jehovah's Witness kid who had to go stand in the hallway every morning when the rest of us stood and patriotically sang, "O Canada." What I didn't think of at the time was how he might have felt if he had stayed and sang it. That might have been worse for him. I'm not sure. I play my French horn with an ensemble some Sunday mornings at other churches. What that church publicly stands for helps me determine whether I'm willing to participate in that location. There are limits to my participation in the spiritual practices of others. Our band played the national anthem in December to open for a Regina Pats hockey game. Originally, we were asked as players to supplement the Salvation Army band, and the expectation was that we would be introduced as Salvationists and wear Salvation Army jackets. I spoke to the band director and told him I could not participate. If I'm going to pretend to be something I'm not, it needs to be something I can generally respect. And though I have tremendous respect for the good work that the Army does, I couldn't identify as a Salvationist due to my perception of their conservative stance on certain social issues. If my social construction of myself varies too widely from how I perceive others are constructing me, it's problematic. So what does this have to do with interspiritual competence? In theory, if we can put our own agendas aside and participate with others, we may have opportunities to build bridges, to demonstrate through conversation and action that we are a community, that harmony and acceptance are pillars of what we stand for. Not adapting to the practices of others maintains a wall that can impair the connection needed for open dialogue. If others see that we are willing to be like them, they will respect that and listen. But, one might argue, people will listen to me whether I take on their practices or not. And in fact, if I take on the practice and they learn that I don't believe in it, they might not trust me, thinking I have an agenda. Or they might feel I have sullied something sacred by participation without belief. I recently waited for access to a sink at work to wash my hands while three young Muslim men washed their feet. One finished and stepped aside to dry his feet and to give me access to the sink. I wonder what would have happened if I'd taken off my shoes and socks and began to wash my feet as well. I didn't. I simply smiled and said, "I see it must be time for prayer," to which I got a big smile and the reply, "You know about Muslims." So I didn't need to actually to wash my feet to get a positive response. Without a degree of participation in other spiritual practices, we can't really know about those practices and the power that they might hold. My partner changed his views on Christian fundamentalism when he met my family, who are largely in that belief system. And I certainly changed my views of Christianity when I attended services with him at the United Church. It was our relationship that prompted us to explore a tiny distance outside of our comfort zone, and we have come to new understandings because of this. Most of us are bridges, for most human endeavors are on a continuum, like the intercultural index, with neighboring and differing viewpoints. A.C. Grayling, in his book, The God Argument, and I am going to return your book, it's coming, which was featured in two Sunday morning presentations by Helen and Ethel, Grayling derides Unitarians in the following passage, and this is a quotation from that book. "Some Unitarian and Universalist groups call themselves humanists, which to all practical purposes they are, though proper humanists, so to speak, often remark that the effect of what members of those groups do is to take religion out of religion while retaining the name of religion, using religion as a synonym most humanists would..." Let me start that again. "Proper humanists, so to speak, often remark that the effect of what members of those groups do is to take religion out of religion while retaining the name of religion, using religion as a synonym, humanists would say a misnomer, for philosophy of life, or as akin to its metaphorical use in football is his religion. Either way, this usage succeeds only in introducing confusion where there is no need for it." That's the end of the quotation from Grayling. To me, this comment about Unitarians shows that Grayling has missed one of the big roles of Unitarianism, and that is to act as a bridge between the religious and the secular. many people find Unitarianism as a result of dissatisfaction with their birth religion, and Unitarianism allows a transition to something they find more meaningful. Unitarianism permits a Christian who is looking for less Christology to retain community, ritual, and routine Sunday morning self-reflection that is found in Christian religious organizations, all the while bringing a different focus and purpose to church attendance. Unitarianism may, therefore, be a stepping stone for some who go on to lose the rituals of church altogether. But for some, it becomes a comfortable destination, a place where some vestiges of Christianity still operate, with candles and hymns and speeches, but without the guilt and the suspension of rationality so often found in mainline Christian churches. So perhaps as an organization, we are, to some degree, exercising interspiritual competence by participating in lighting candles, retaining a symbol left from a Christ-centered past, but attaching a new meaning to it. In the same way that reciting the Lord's Prayer in public might take on the new meaning of demonstrating the importance of community participation rather than the meaning of confessing to God. We speak of being born Catholic or born Unitarian, though this is a self-constructed or socially constructed label. There is nothing observable about a newborn that identifies her or him as a Unitarian. Even such things as gender are arguably socially constructed. We make sense of everything in our world through language, which is constructed. So if we have adopted any spiritual label, if we're not born Catholic or Unitarian, but later adopt these labels because they seem to fit, then we all have demonstrated some degree of interspiritual competence. My friend Natalie arrived at that party back in university and was the cultural and communication bridge for me. She formally introduced me to Michel and his roommate. She helped me to understand the conversations that were inaccessible to me. And the dog knew her, so it sat politely and let me pet it for a considerable length of time. In the same way, how can we act as bridges, both individually and collectively, to promote community, understanding, and acceptance? How adept are you at adapting to the deeper aspects of other spiritual practices rather than just the superficial ones? How far are you willing to go? Are you willing and able to be a bridge for yourself and others? What are the limits to your participation in the spiritual practices of others? Do the benefits to participation outweigh the costs of feeling inauthentic and the possible judgment of others? I think there's value in considering these questions, but I can't believe, for me, they will ever be completely answered. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Andrew. That was very interesting. And I was reflecting on my own background, where I describe myself as a cultural Catholic. Because, you know, if I go into a Catholic church, I understand what the symbolism is. I understand why people are doing things they are. Although that's beginning to change, because quite a few things have changed since I was a practicing Catholic. But it is interesting to, if I go into a Protestant church, it's rather different. And if I go into a mosque or a synagogue, I feel like I'm a total stranger. I'm coming from another land. But I think that it's always interesting. I don't feel any hostility towards Catholicism. I just don't believe it. So I can go back, and sometimes I do choose to say, if I'm, say, at a wedding or something like that, I would sometimes choose to sing the hymns or songs or whatever they're doing and so on. But, and I would sometimes do that in other places as well. But depending on how comfortable I feel and whether I feel that people are going to sort of stamp me. So that would be my, it has to be my decision. Thank you.
I was just curious. When you said when you were talking about how a baby would be like something like genders are like basically socially ingrained, are you kind of one of those people that believe that gender constructs are basically socially ingrained and have nothing to do with biology at all? And also the basically thing, if you aren't, wouldn't it be a better way to describe it that a baby would be kind of arrogant of if he was religious or not? Or his gender, because, you know, the only thing he's worried about is basically, you know, if he gets his next meal and if he's cared for.
Good question. There are different views about gender.
I know, and those views are stupid because anyone can know. The reason why gender roles come in is because, you know, gender roles are like social, like those things, those contracts, which I don't really believe those things. I believe they're the stupidest things ever came out of a person's mouth. And to me, when I've done a bit of research on it, basically gender roles, basically like all those gender roles are like social, like gender things come from biology. We're biologically thing. Like, yeah, and understand there's like people who feel psychologically, they feel like they're a man stuck in a woman's body and like a woman stuck in a man's body. I know that, but just whole things like gender roles or like all those social like contracts about that come from biology. We're born... We know our species came, like, basically had those roles implanted in our origins of our species and that sort of thing. And I don't know. I've just always thought that theory about gender as a social construct was probably about as stupid as the creationist theory.
I think we are all born into culture as we know it, and we can't get outside of our culture. We can't get outside of any of the cultures that exist in the world. So we don't really have sort of a comparison example to say, if we had no culture, how would a child grow up? How would they feel about their own identity in terms of their gender? So I guess I'm sort of reserving judgment on that one, and I'm listening to people who say that their experience of how they feel about themselves is different from how other people are putting labels on them. So I guess that's as far as I can go on that. I was born as a man, most people would say, and I feel like a man. So I don't have any gender conflict, but I do understand that some people do.
Who is next? Somebody else?
Andrew, thank you. Lots to think about, as usual. I was thinking about my own journey and how, yes, how much I agree with you about when you call our experience a bridge as Unitarians or as interspiritually competent, although my competence I question sometimes. However, I was really born an agnostic. I mean, I came into a culture of agnosticism, and as I grew older and tried a lot of faiths, I participated and thought I was convinced, even from time to time, but eventually slacked off my search. But I missed something, and that was community. And I have read before that the word religion can be construed to mean community. And I'm still smarting from the comments of Grayling, because picky semantics, giving meanings to, you know, religion or whatever you call it. I just say, call it what you want, and come and join your community on Sundays. That's what it's about.
Hi there, I'm Sheena August, and I want to share my experience in Egypt because it was it's a very culturally different place, and I had never been in a country where the religion is predominantly Muslim. And then I wanted to comment and give a situation and talk about a question I have about putting people at ease or being comfortable or showing my interest in other people's culture and religion and how to do that and to sort of negotiate that a bit. So, of course, I was in Egypt, and that's a Muslim country, and I bought an entire new wardrobe to go there. And that is because I wear things that are bright and short and fitted, and in Egypt, they are dark and long and not really fitted. And so there are some exceptions to that. But people thought that I was kind of being odd about that, and they just said, well, wear what you're comfortable with, and I'm sure you have something and it'll be fine. And I thought, well, no, actually, it's not that I'm trying to fit in or trying to be Muslim. I just want to make sure that I'm being really respectful and people feel at ease. And I noticed when I was there, because I brought some of my own kind of more colorful clothes that I would wear on the cruise ship that we floated down the Nile on, that where there were just tourists and other people that would understand the culture of my clothing. And but I know that when we went out into the communities, the small communities, and into the, you know, the city of Cairo, I noticed when I wore long, dark clothes, people were much more, people were lovely anyway the entire time I was in Egypt. I want that to be known. People were wonderful. But they were more prepared to connect and to see you in a light of a person who would want to know about them or be interested in them, not just a person who's exploring the antiquities of their country. So I found that that was a good way to connect with other people, and I actually formed really close relationships and learned a lot, and it was really great. But I know in my own country here now, there are a little bit of religious and cultural differences that I have with people, and I'm very well aware, because they all know my position on religion, that if I, for instance, with my Christian friends and family members, if I say the Lord's Prayer, which I know well because I was raised as a Catholic, or if I do anything with them that expresses an awareness or a connection with them in this, I don't want them to feel like I'm mocking them, and I've never considered having the conversation with them, so I choose to be quiet. But I'm wondering how, and then with people I don't know as well, how do you connect to know what would be appropriate to them? Like, I liked your example of the Muslim people that you had met, and you acknowledged that you were aware of their practices before prayer. But how do you gauge that, I guess, or how do you do that?
That's a really good question and a tough one. I mean, I was about to say you have to know your audience, because then your audience is, you will know what's appropriate. But if you don't know your audience, if it's someone that you've just met, that's a good question. I suppose listen and ask questions to gauge sort of their position and where they're coming from. I'm sure that there are things that I could do that to one person would be welcome and acceptable, and to another person, even of the same religion, for example, who would be offended by what I did. So, you know, just because someone adopts a label doesn't mean that it's a monolithic group. There are differences within a group. And so I'm sure there's a real art to that that I have not mastered, but being able to know people and where they're coming from, I think, probably is the key if you're trying to build a bridge there.
I'll make this the last question. Thank you.
I have a feeling, based on my own experience, that if we broaden our concept of what is spiritual, which fits more in with Martin Luther King talked about and Susan B. Anthony, I have to get one of the quotes that you read last week about what she said, that if you are strong enough to reach out to those people who are involved in social, wanting to change social issues, and you call that spirituality, and you connect with them spiritually, then I think that wipes out a whole field of, you don't have to be that sensitive to connect with people who want to bring about change. And that's what I keep hoping, that more and more people will say, that's spirituality.
I see what you're saying, and I appreciate that. Coming from the background that I come from, it would be hard for me to say that there isn't another side to that coin, that there are people who do believe in social change, but it's not the kind of social change that you and I might like to see. And spirituality for those people has a pretty narrow definition. And so it would be hard to win those people over to your argument. But I agree with what you're saying, Dave.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's obviously inspired lots of thought, and thanks again.